Chapter 15. Bruce Shannon was shivering as he was finally deposited at Kersevay House. Despite spending almost 3 hours looking for Bergner in the snowy fields, they had seen neither hide nor hair of the chief executive. He looked at his phone. Thankfully, due to pressure his family had placed on the phone company, the mobile signal in Blan was good. He had no messages, missed calls or emails. He wasn't sure if this was a good sign or not, and wondered about Bergner's disappearance. He had made sure that the deal he had struck ensured that nobody, not even the Swede, would be hurt. He flicked down his contact list and clicked on the name Trenton Casely. Bruce let it ring for longer than he would normally before he clicked the phone off. "Get off the bint and back on the fucking job," he whispered to himself, as he stood at the lift doors and pressed the up button. It was time to face his mother. John McGuinness's home was dark, lit only by candles, but surprisingly warm, in the lounge at least, thanks to a portable gas fire, which gave the room a welcoming red glow. McGuinness was lean and fit for his age, with a chiselled face and a square jaw which jutted out as he spoke. His flattened nose marked him out as a pugilist. By the way he carried himself, not an unsuccessful one, thought Daly, though his peak must have been more than half a century before. An old dog panted beside the fire. McGuinness patted it as Daly looked on.
"If I had just been a wee bit quicker doon these stairs, Mr. Daly, I tell you, I'd have given that big bastard a surprise."
"Big, you say, so you caught sight of him?"
"Oh, aye. He must have heard the dog barking and me moving up the stairs. By the time I got doon, he had shifted out the door. But I saw him disappear behind the big hedge at the front. It was dark, you understand, but he was a big bloke, dressed in black. Dark clothes, at any rate. I didn't see his coupon, unfortunately."
"What woke you?"
"Ach, the old boy here," he said, scratching the dog's head. "He's all the company I've got since my wife passed away. Sleeps in his basket beside the bed now. Bessie would have had a fit. She didn't let him upstairs at all."
He smiled down at the animal.
"Bit like myself these days. Both past their best. Aye, but I tell you, we're no done yet."
Daly looked around the room. Pictures and old photographs danced in the shadows cast by the flaming candles. A row of trophies glittered on the mantelpiece.
"You've won a few prizes in your time. I hope none of them were stolen." "No, well, not that I can see, anyway. He went through all the drawers in my sideboard, mind, but he left my wee collection of boxing awards alone. Ach, they're no worth a toss now, no in money at least. But they're important to me."
He stared along the row of small cups, shields and tiny fighters set on plinths, tight-packed above the fireplace.
"Started boxing in the army and found out I had a talent for it. Different in they days, Mr. Daly. None of the fuss and corruption that you see now. Two men, straight up and down, Queensbury rules. And may the best man win, as my old drill instructor used to say."
"When did you pack it in?"
"Oh, let me think. I was a pro for 5 years, light featherweight, fighting it to a gem in Paisley. Good days, but bugger me, it was hard to make ends meet. By the time I was in my mid-30s, I knew fine the game was up, so I came back home, way back in the 60s.
"So you're from Kinloch?"
"Aye, well, sort of. I was brought up in Blan. Been in the toon for 50-odd years, mind."
"I know the power's off and everything, but if you could give me a call tomorrow and let me know what, if anything, is missing, I would be most obliged."
"Aye, nae bother. But I can tell you about one missing item now."
"Oh, what's that?"
"Just one thing, as I can make out," he said. "Strangest thing. An old photo my daughter had blown up for me. It used to sit in a frame on the wall, just over there."
"Can you describe it for me?"
"I can do better than that, officer."
He fished out a faded yellow folder, filled with photographs, most of which were black and white.
"Now let me see."
Daly looked on for a few moments, as he searched amongst the old images, peering through the gloom with a pair of spectacles balanced on the end of his nose.
"Ah, here we are, Mr. Daly."
McGuinness handed the detective a small photograph. Even in the poor light, it looked faded, sepia rather than monochrome, curling at the edges with age.
"That's the very picture."
Daly studied it. A big man was standing straight-backed, dressed in a suit and a button-down collared shirt. He was broad-shouldered, with a gut, but looked powerful and a bit like John McGuinness himself, gave the impression of strength despite his declining years. He had a long, drooping moustache. In his arms was a small girl, her hair in a bow, no more than a couple of years old. Beside him, a young boy stared out from the photograph with a disgruntled scowl. He was wearing very long shorts, one sock pulled up to his knee, the other down at his ankle.
"Is that you as a boy, Mr. McGuinness?"
"No, no, me. The man with the tash is my great-uncle, Nat Stewart. This photo was taken just before he left Blan."
"What did he do?"
"Och, he was a blacksmith, way back, when folks still had horses and carts. An unfortunate man in many ways, but a bit of a legend in our family."
"Oh, why so?"
"We were a family of tinkers, some would say, though my mother wouldna hear that name in the house. He was like the head of the clan, the main man. He had his land stolen for him. Aye, stolen for us all."
"What land?"
"Long time ago now, Mr. Daly. But my uncle used to own the land where the big house is built in Blan. You know, on the cliff. He had his blacksmith's shop there. The place had been in our family hundreds of years. Maybe it's longer."
"Who are the kids?"
"That's two of his grandchildren," replied McGuinness with a sigh. "See the wee lassie?"
"Yes, what about her?"
"Her mother, his daughter, died in childbirth when she was being born."
"Oh, that's sad."
"Och, some folk said the woman wasn't in her right mind. The tale is that she was in and out of an asylum most of her adult life. Even worse when her man buggered off and left her on her ain. No easy in these days, Mr. Daly. What wi' nae social security or the like. Would have been hell to pay if the big man had got hold of him right enough. He didna suffer fools gladly, so they say. Looks like it, would you no agree?"
"Yes, I wouldn't pick a fight with him," replied Daly with a smile. "What happened to the children?"
"Old Nat brought them up like his ain. Took them with him when he left. I never seen my wee pal again."
"Oh, did you know them?"
"Aye, me and the wee boy, Lachie. We used to run about Blan when we were wains. Bad-tempered wee bugger he was tae, always ready for a scrap. But he was my buddy. That's how I got the photograph enlarged. I tell you, Mr. Daly, see, when you get to my age, you get fair nostalgic."
"Would you mind if I took this with me? I'll bring it back. I just want to make a copy so we know what we're looking for if we come across the thief."
"Aye, be my guest. Mind if you don't bring it back. Me and the old fella here'll come looking for you," said McGuinness, patting the old dog again.
The animal looked up at Daly, who was studying the photograph intently and stroking his chin. He took the phone from his pocket and snapped a quick image. Scott was shivering as they pulled up in the car park of the Black Wherry Inn. The small hotel was near the centre of Blan, on the main road, between a small estate of 5 private bungalows on one side and a row of cottages on the other. After nearly 4 hours in the freezing snow searching for Lars Bergner, Superintendent Symington had arrived and taken charge. Because Cursivay House was now bursting at the seams, she had made a forward operational base at the small hotel, where Scott was now to spend the night. Apparently, apart from a bemused honeymoon couple who had thought spending a quiet time on the idyllic west coast of Scotland over New Year was a good idea, the hotel was empty.
"That'll be a honeymoon to remember," thought Scott,
as he watched a dozen freezing police officers pile into the establishment to get dry, warm and fed before being transported back to Kinloch. He was thankful, though, that this meant he wouldn't have to spend another night in Cursivay House. For a second, the small boy's face passed through his mind, but, as he was soon enveloped in the warmth of the hotel bar, these thoughts soon passed. A small woman with grey hair was fussing around her new visitors.
"Jist get they wet clothes off, gentlemen. There'll be hot food in the go in about an hour.
"'Nay menus, yous'll have to take what's on offer. "'Just lucky we've got the generator, "'or it would be cans of soup heated o'er the fire.'
"'Like Kinloch, Blan and the rest of South Kintyre was without power.
"'Which one of yous is Brian Scott?' she called.
"'Once he'd left his jacket steaming on a radiator, "'he walked over to introduce himself.
"'You'll be Jesse, then?'
"'Aye, and you're the famous Detective Sergeant Scott?' she said, winking at the policeman. "'I've heard a lot about you.'
"'Oh, good, I hope,' mumbled Scott, starting to feel slightly uncomfortable under the scrutiny of yet another formidable hotel chatelaine.
"'Och, I thought you might be a bit taller, but she's right enough. You're no an affront to the eye.'
"'Cheers, I'm sure. I take it you mean Annie.'
"'Who else?' she replied, a large grin spread across her face. "'I know all about you and her and all those cosy wee nights at the county. "'I've been telt to gie you our best room. "'Honoured, right enough. "'Come wi' me.'
"'Jesse led Scott along a narrow passageway and up a creaking staircase. "'The hotel looked old, with its wood panelling and red carpet. "'But, unlike the fading grandeur of the county, "'the black wherry was newly painted, neat and well-maintained.' Scott was surprised to see his case sitting on one of the beds in the bright twin room. The room contained the usual chest of drawers, wardrobe, and assortment of brochures detailing the delights of the area, but had a fresh, new smell.
"'We've just had a refurb, Brian, so make yourself at home. Because of this power cut, we'll be putting off the electricity in the night. Since it's Hogmanay, I wouldn't think that'll be too early, mind you.'
"'Aye, thanks.' "'What's with the name, by the way?'
"'Jesse. Oh, my granny was called Jesse, and her granny, if you get my drift. "'Used to be the name my family gied to the first-born grandchild, boy or lassie.'
"'I'm sure the lads were chuffed to ten with that.'
"'We stopped that when my Uncle Jesse tried to droon his mother because of it. "'But as my ain granny, Jesse, used to say, "'Don't affront the name, and the name'll no affront you.'
"'Aye, right,' Scott hesitated. "'I was actually meaning the name of the hotel, to be honest.'
"'Oh, the Black Wherry, right. "'That was the name gied to the vessels of the night, if you know what I mean. "'Smugglers? "'They were rife here, oh, a long time ago now. "'The story goes that when Aeneas Ronald got too old to see in the dark to cross the North Channel, "'he built this place to stick two fingers up at the law, in a manner of speaking.' she said, with a tinge of embarrassment, suddenly remembering Scott's profession.
"'A nice wee place, anyhow.
We do our best. And I tell you something else. As long as you and the boys are guests in this hotel, yous needna worry about any awkward questions or the like.'
"'Well, that would be very good, thank you. It's much appreciated.'
Jesse sidled up to the policeman.
"'Mind you, "'It wouldna do any harm to let me know just what's happening. "'We're hearing terrible stories in the village about all these goings-on. "'Old Mrs. McLaughlin was too feared to take in her washing the day, "'frozen stiff on the line, apparently, covered in snow, "'her Sunday drawers and everything.'
"'Jessie shook her head, tutting.
"'If you can gie me an idea o' the right o' things, well... "'I can make sure these gossips' tales are nipped in the bud,' she declared, looking up at Scott, hopefully.
"'You probably know as much as me. "'Now, is any of that grub you were talking about on the go? "'I'm fair famished,' said Scott, anxious to change the subject.
"'Aye, of course,' replied Jesse with a sniff. "'If you want to freshen up, I'll have something for you in the bar in 20 minutes.'
"'No, another one,' thought Scott with a smile. But, for the first time since his arrival in Blan, he felt almost normal. Chapter 16 Bruce watched his cousin Maxwell fidgeting in his chair. Despite her age and marginalised position within the company, Ailsa could make life uncomfortable for the most confident interlocutor. Bruce knew it would be his turn next.
"'I must say, I had expected some nasty surprises at this year's AGM, but the disappearance of Mr. Bergner and all this death and brutality, not to mention the connection with Archie, has all come as a bit of a shock.
Nothing to worry you, Aunt Elsa. In fact, the police tell me that the deaths of the two journalists may be totally unconnected with the family.
And what about the skeleton? Just a coincidence, Maxie?
Maxwell raised his eyebrows at the contraction of his name, but decided not to make the point.
You know how some people see us, Elsa. Folk here, well, we're of them, but not part of them any more. Must be a bit galling to see what this family has become.
He stole a look at Bruce, one eyebrow raised.
Mostly we're a resounding success. Regarding these bones, they still haven't managed to get DNA evidence, and may not be able to at all. They've been bleached in some chemical or other. My guess is that this is just a sick prank. Let's face it, everyone in this sorry hole knows about that stupid bloody curse.
And Lars decided to pop out for an impromptu hike in the snow, I don't doubt.
His mother's response made Bruce snigger. Undaunted, Maxwell sat forwards on his chair.
This is the most important meeting in the history of this organization. We simply cannot let anything affect the way we take this company forward. I'm sure there is a reasonable explanation for Lars' disappearance.
The phone buzzing in his pocket distracted him.
I have to go. We can talk about this at the meeting proper tomorrow, he said, getting up to leave, a sudden look of concern across his face.
Problem, Maxie? Goaded Bruce.
Nothing I can't handle, cousin. You stick to what you're best at and let me handle the important stuff.
He excused himself and left Ailes's apartment, high in Cursive House.
Arrogant prick, said Bruce,
reaching for the glass of whisky on the small table before him.
Clever prick, added his mother. Please go easy on the bloody sauce this year, darling. You made a complete arse of yourself at the last meeting. It really doesn't help our cause.
He stared at his glass, taking a few moments to consider what she'd said.
He's not as clever as you think, Mother. And as far as our cause is concerned, if we are to continue along the usual path of soft power and persuasion, we'll get to where we always end up.
Nowhere.
Maxwell isn't the boss yet. Oh, come on!
Not for the first time, Bruce was riled by his mother's opinion.
My uncle is a demented old man slavering into a bib and shitting in a potty. Do you really believe for one second that he'll ever regain his senses? Please, Bruce, less profanity. Of course he'll never recover. But while he's alive, Maxwell cannot get his hands fully on the reins of power. It's only a matter of time until the old boy croaks.
Ailsa looked levelly at her son.
And I suppose you think the same about me. Please don't, Mum. Must every conversation we have be this way? No wonder I drink. I'm bloody sick of it. I'm taking steps of my own this year, if you must know.
As quickly as he said it, he regretted it.
Wonderful, Bruce. Another of your pathetic little plots that invariably come to nothing and make you look even more inadequate than you actually are. Oh, bugger this!
He slammed his glass onto the table and got to his feet, his face red with fury.
When will you get it into your head that this bloody pantomime we attend every year is just that? The real decisions are made in Zurich or New York or in Maxie's new office in the fucking Shard. Blan, this bloody house, it's all just a relic of the past. Give it up, Mother. This company's true wealth will always be based on the mineral contracts in Russia and the Far East, negotiated in the 50s and 60s. Your cousin forgets that. Oh, great. Another wander into the past. It's the same as this bloody place. You've always hated it here. Do you wonder why? Living with the ghost of my dead brother for company every year? I sincerely hope that skeleton is his. Then maybe we can move on with our lives. Surely 50 years in mourning is enough.
She placed her china teacup back on its delicate saucer and sighed wearily.
"Let's imagine that we leave the dead where they are. What then? What about the living? It's clear to me that you have as little regard for them."
"Mother, I see you when I can. You wouldn't want me hanging about like a bad smell all the time. I love you, you know that."
"No, not me."
For the first time in the conversation, Ailsa raised her voice.
"What about your poor daughter? Have you even spoken to her since you arrived? Or were you too keen to get your face in a glass as soon as you walked through the door? You're a disgrace."
He took a deep breath. No, he hadn't seen his daughter. Yes, the first thing he'd done when he arrived was pour a large measure of malt whiskey. A disgrace? Yes, he probably was. Yet again, Bruce's mother had succeeded in making his feelings of self-loathing even more pronounced. Yet again, the guilt he felt over his daughter almost made him cry out with the pain he felt in his heart. Did this ever change? Did these feelings alter from year to year? He drained his glass and left the room, with only the familiar feelings of deflation, defeat, and shame for company. His oldest friends. Snow covered just about everything. Gnarled roots poked from the snow like beckoning blackened fingers. A silent come hither from the realm beneath. Heavy fir branches drooped, bowed under their chilling blanket, as though weeping at the burden. The sharp, craggy lines of a large boulder left behind by an ancient glacier were cloaked once more in white, a fleeting return to the frozen world of long ago. On the ratstone, however, not a single flake had settled. Its black eminence glowered, harsh, unforgiving, irresistible. It lay darker than the dark night as the last hours of the old year seeped away. Neither the winter moon nor stars glinted across its surface, as though terrified their distant twinkling light might be sucked in, consumed in a dance with time itself. The man ducked under the line of yellow police tape, stretched between two metal posts. An unseen animal rushed through the undergrowth. Snow cascaded from an overburdened branch. He watched it spring back to life in the beam of his large torch, the pine needles green and sharp in a soft white world. He mumbled under his breath, the words old and barely perceptible. Then, in a louder voice, in the common tongue, he spoke. "Light of the sun, radiance of the moon, depth of the sea, splendor of the fire, stability of the earth, today I return." He sank to his knees, the snow halfway up his thighs, and pulled back the sleeve of his jacket. His flesh was as white as the snow. The steel of the short dagger he held glittered in the torchlight. The calluses on his hand were at odds with the neat manicure that left the tip of his fingernails white and even. He ran the sharp blade down the length of his thumb. The thin line of blood soon became a rivulet. He leaned forwards and rubbed it along the length of the stone.
"Be still now."
The woman's voice was quiet but insistent. She pulled his head back, revealing his pale throat. The beam cast by the torch revealed his face as an echo of the skull that lay beneath. His eye sockets were dark and lifeless. His cheekbones threatened almost to pierce his skin.
"Your life in my hands. Your soul is my gift. Your blood is your beginning and end."
She held the blade close to his throat, the tiny pressure sending another stream of red along its length.
"Will you give yourself to me this night?"
"Aye."
She hesitated for a minute, feeling the power of life and death course through her, balancing need with want, existence and oblivion.
"So be it."
The knife moved gently in the darkness as the wind began to whip through the trees. The old song would be sung again. The serenade had begun. Linton, Brady and Maxwell stared at the bank of blinking screens in the old outbuilding that had been converted into a large communications facility at Cursive House. With a wealth of modern technology at their fingertips, the Shannon family were no longer isolated when they paid their annual visit to their clifftop retreat. Even the local power cut didn't pose a problem, due to the state-of-the-art backup generators the Shannon family had installed. Maxwell enjoyed the fact that, from this place where horses had once been stabled, one of the world's most successful companies, its tendrils reaching out to every continent, could be managed. He felt little joy now as rows of numbers flashed and changed colour, mostly to red.
"What is this? I mean, how is it even possible?" croaked Maxwell,
the sight in front of him making his throat constrict.
"We're losing money across all of our ghosts in the USA. How is this fucking happening?"
"Please don't refer to them as ghosts," said Linton, peering through his small spectacles at another red line on the screen. "These are diversified public holding companies."
"Yeah, that nobody knows about but us," added Brady. "At first I thought this was a blip, but it can't be. If this was a general run on the market, it would be bad enough, but it only involves organizations in which we have our shareholding. We're being deliberately shorted on every front."
Shannon thumped the desk in front of him with a clenched fist.
"Not only is this virtually impossible to do in such a coordinated way, who the fuck knows about the connection other than us?"
"Do I really need to answer that?" sighed Linton.
"Only four of us have knowledge of the complete picture. Others are aware of our discreet PLC operations, but we four are the only ones who know how it all fits together."
"And there's no elephant in the room, guys, if you get my drift," said Brady,
looking between both men, his hand in which he held a glass of bourbon, shaking slightly.
"That is a fucking ridiculous notion, Charles," said Maxwell. "Are you seriously saying that Lars Bergner disappeared into the snow this afternoon in order to cause a run on our company's assets around the world? Come on!"
"Are you kidding me, Maxwell?"
Brady stood, flinging his glass onto the carpeted floor, where it bounced rather than smashed.
"We own controlling shares in 100 multinational PLCs. Remember? Spread the risk across many jurisdictions, too big to fail. Only me, you, Linton, and Lars know about everyone and the full extent of our exposure. So Lars takes a walk in the fucking snow, and a few hours later the bottom is falling out of every one of those organizations, every fucking one. Even your dumb niece would be able to work this out."
"Don't patronize me, you prick. Your job is to keep an eye on this. How come this is the first I've heard about it?"
"Only started happening in New York about 3 hours ago," replied Linton.
"There lies the good news, though."
"How can you possibly extrapolate good news from this?" asked Maxwell.
Linton looked at his wristwatch. "Trading stops on Wall Street soon. The markets don't start up again until the day after tomorrow because of the New Year break. We have to source what's happening and fix it before then, or..."
"Or we have to go to the rest of the board and tell them they've gone from being one of the richest families on the planet to paupers overnight," said Brady. "I've just worked out how much we've lost in the last 90 minutes or so."
"Well, do tell," insisted Maxwell.
"The thick end of $1 billion. If this spreads around the world after the holidays, well, I don't need to tell you guys."
"No, you don't. And may I remind you, gentlemen, that we have the AGM of that board tomorrow. The consequences for us would be much worse than mere bankruptcy. Collectively, we've broken almost every company law and protocol that exists. We'd make those chaps from Enron look like the backstreet gang that robbed the corner store."
Linton took off his thin glasses and rubbed them with his handkerchief. "Regardless of the jurisdiction, they'd throw away the key."
"Fucking cool hand over here," remarked Brady.
I don't need reminding that we're stuck up in this eyrie with the world collapsing around our ears. Shit, even the power has failed. I sure hope that old man can keep the generators going.
It's not his job. We have contractors, said Maxwell. Don't worry about anything else but this. We have to work this problem and work it quick.
And what of Lars? Asked Linton.
Lars is on his fucking own.
Maxwell stared at the screen as yet more numbers turned red.
And what if someone else gets wind there's something up? All this is well disguised as far as we're concerned, but it's already causing ripples around the business world. Some of the PLCs will be beyond the point of no return soon. I'm thinking mainly of your aunt, Maxwell. She's no fool. Plus, she retains a merry band of most able advisers.
Linton placed his spectacles firmly back on his nose.
They can't be that sharp. We've not been discovered so far, said Brady.
Nothing like this has happened before.
Shut up, both of you, said Maxwell. We turn our current location to our advantage. We can limit internet access and cut the power when required. In short, we keep everyone that matters cooped up here until we sort this out. Lars's disappearing act gives us the perfect excuse.
Happy New Year.
Brady grimaced at the thought. Chapter 17 Scott was now in the Black Wherry. To his left, drinks were being served across a busy counter, while to his right, a few men stood around a pool table. At the back of the room, a small group of locals looked on as a man, hand poised in front of his face, aimed at a dartboard, one eye closed in concentration. An old man with wavy grey hair sat on his own at a table, staring at a folded newspaper through old-fashioned reading glasses. The subdued atmosphere surprised Scott. Though it was early evening, it was Hogmanay, but Scott detected none of the exuberance or high spirits normally associated with New Year's Eve in Scotland. He ordered a coffee from the barmaid, who told him to take a seat and that the beverage would be brought to him. He sidled up to the old man reading the newspaper and asked if he minded sharing his table. The man nodded and smiled, so Scott sat down, pleased to take the weight off his feet and be out of the snow. He had agonized about leaving his room and putting himself in the way of temptation in the public bar, but he needed company. Sitting alone upstairs, the face of the little boy had begun to encroach on his thoughts.
"It's no real," he kept whispering to himself. "Just get over this and you'll be back to normal, Brian boy."
He repeated these words over and over again, like a mantra. Secretly, though, he found it hard to be convinced of their veracity. The child had seemed so real. He cursed himself for being so stupid and allowing abusive alcohol to burden his life in such a way. At least here, despite the subdued atmosphere, he was amongst other folk. Yes, he would love to be waiting for a large whiskey to land on his table rather than a black coffee, but he was determined to beat the urge.
"Quiet in here, eh?"
he said to the old man, who peered at him over the rim of his glasses.
"Aye, so it is. Won't be later on, mind." "So everyone's just saving themselves for tonight, then? Oh, well. I'm Brian Scott, by the way. Pleased to meet you." "Jock Munro, at your service, Brian."
He took Scott's hand in a firm grip.
"You're a police officer, if I'm not mistaken." "Is it that obvious? Well, we don't get too many visitors at this time of year, and bearing in mind the rumours in the village, it wasn't too hard to put two and two together."
Jock had a deep, resonant voice, and spoke slowly with just a hint of local accent.
"And don't worry, I'll not be fishing for information. I spent too many years doing that for a living to be worried about such things now."
"How do you mean?"
"I was a member of the Fourth Estate for more years than was wise, Brian. A hack, in other words. I worked on the dailies in Glasgow for 20 years,
until I saw the light and started writing for myself.
"What kind of stuff do you write?" asked Scott, warming to the old man.
"Oh, I had a pretty eclectic portfolio. Latterly, biography, but children's books, history, sci-fi, even a bit of crime. I retired a few years ago, so I prefer reading to writing now."
He noted Scott's slight sigh as his coffee was placed on the table by a young waitress.
"Are you on duty?"
"What? Oh, aye, well, sort of," said Scott. "You'll know yourself a policeman's work is never done and all that."
"Goodness me, things must have changed. I remember sharing a bottle of whisky or two in the old press bar in Glasgow with a lot of cops who weren't particularly concerned whether they were on duty or not. Different days, I dare say."
"Oh, aye, you can say that again. Anything stronger than a wine gum new, and you're down to the supermarket looking for a job as a security guard. So, when will things liven up here, Jock?"
"Oh, no until the folk here have been to the kirk. We're an old farming community here, Brian. Most of the lads here will head off to church and sing a couple of hymns and listen to our minister before they get in the mood for the bells. Strange, we normally see a Shannon or two in the bar before now on Hogmanay."
"They're feared to step out of Kersevay House, Jock," shouted one of the pool players. "Last I heard, they were all cooped up in the big ballroom with half of the SAS for company. I heard a Chinook was on the way to ferry the whole lot of them back to London just in case the Olgins get the rest of them. Is that no right, officer?"
shouted a thin man holding a pool cue.
"You all know fine I can't say anything about such things. Get on with your game and stop gossiping like a parcel of old women."
"Who are these Olgins?"
he asked Jock, in a much quieter voice. The old man leaned forwards.
"They have a lot of names, Brian. The Healers, the Magicians, the Society of the Golden Bough, even the Wise Men from the Good Book itself. You would probably call them druids."
"What? Seriously? The only druids I've seen prance about Stonehenge with white sheets on their heads and they funny hats."
"There's lots that would say the same. But as I said, old traditions run deep in places like this. Traditions, stories, folklore, the ghosts of the past, Mr. Scott. There's a thin veil between our world and the place beyond. Of that, I've no doubt."
Scott looked at his coffee cup, deep in thought.
"I don't think a family like the Shannons will give two hoots about druids or the like,"
he said, eventually, forcing a smile. His thoughts transported to the terrifying experience he'd had at Kersevay House.
"They might say that. But I wonder if it's true," replied Jock. "That old house is built on the site of an ancient tinker's encampment. You can think what you like about the tinkers, but they have some of the oldest human DNA on the planet. In every sense, they are the old people. Likely on these islands for millennia before the Scots or anyone else got here. People think of them as travellers, but their name refers to their skill with metal, tin, in the old days. The family of tinkers in Blan, the Stuarts, have lived here for hundreds of years, aye, maybe thousands. A tinker's curse is not a thing to be taken lightly, and the Shannons were cursed with one a long time ago. 100 years, to be exact."
"I wouldn't have thought a man like you would believe in such things."
"When I was your age, Brian, aye, and long before, there was nobody more sceptical than me. But I tell you, as the years go on and the little notions you have in your head get more pronounced, well, the less of a sceptic you become.
The druids were guardians of their world, making medicines from plants, caring for man and creature alike, though they had another side.
Don't tell me. They liked a good party and a few bevies.
No. You just have to read Julius Caesar to find out that he thought them to be the most formidable force Rome had faced. There were many cruelties, execution, torture, barbarity beyond belief.
Bit schizophrenic, is it no? One minute you're making them sound like a cross between Mother Teresa and James Herriot, the next like Hannibal Lecter.
They would do anything to defend their land. Caesar had them massacred on their sacred island, Ennismon, Anglesey as we know it. But he just pushed the power base north.
You talk like it was all yesterday, Jock.
By our measure, it's a long time ago. But ask the old hill or the stone about time, and you'll get a different response.
Aye. Right, replied Scott.
Suddenly he didn't feel as content again. Daly was driving down Main Street in Kinloch when he spotted Mary trudging through the snow. He stopped his car and wound down the window.
When did you get back to the town?
Oh, about half an hour ago. Superintendent Symington said I could take the rest of the night off. She's still in Blan with a support unit. I got back to the station with the backshift guys.
Jump in. I'll give you a lift. Where are you off to?
She hesitated, then jumped into the car.
I'm going to Angus's parents' house to take in the new year, she said, with a forced smile.
Daly smiled back, though his heart sank. He tried his best to keep any contact with Mary to a minimum, work only. With Kinloch being so small in size, when Dunn had begun her relationship with the young doctor, they had bumped into each other in the town's bars and restaurants. Over time, Daly had learned to cope with seeing her with her new boyfriend. But the sight of her now, at such close quarters in his car, made his heart leap. He was about to drive away when his phone rang. He answered it, a look of surprise growing on his face.
"What's up?"
asked Dunn as he ended the call.
"Seems the late Colin Grant had quite a bit of money in his bank account."
"Oh, how much is quite a bit?"
"Nearly £500,000.
"Wow, really? But I thought he was just a freelance hack."
"Didn't we all? More than that, most of this money came from one source."
"Who?"
"The big payments into his account all come from Shannon International, through an account registered to one of their subsidiaries in Switzerland." Daly thought for a moment. "I'll drop you off, then I better take a trip back to Blan. Time I had a word with Maxwell Shannon."
"So he wasn't on the trail of some cult, then?"
"Listen, don't bother dropping me off," replied Dunn. "I'll come with you."
"What about Angus and his folks?"
"Oh, don't worry,"
she smiled.
"I've never liked Hogmanay anyway."
Veronica fussed around a vase of flowers on a small table beneath the pulpit. She could hear the clunk of the old pipes as the ancient oil-fired heating system stuttered into life. With no electricity, the church was bedecked in candles, giving the old white walls and rows of wooden pews an otherworldly feel. It would be a struggle to keep warm on the old kirk at Blan this Hogmanay. She watched her husband as he prepared for the last service of the old year. He had a long black overcoat on over his vestments and was thumbing through the pages of tonight's sermon with gloved hands. He looked up at her and smiled.
"Bloody cold in here, love,"
he said, stamping his feet on the floor to aid his circulation.
"I hope the punters have had a dram or two before they arrive. They'll need it."
"Not too many, though. Do you remember old Mr. Hunter last year?"
She laughed.
"Snored the whole way through. I hope your sermon will be short, Iggy. You know there's not a great collective attention span at this time of year."
"Oh, no worries. Short, sweet, and with the promise of salvation, and a joke at the end. What more could any congregation want on Hogmanay?"
His smile faded.
"Though,
Not everyone's going to be full of the joys, considering what's been going on and all.
It's your job to raise spirits, my love. I'm sure you'll be equal to the task.
Make them forget about old bones and dead bodies, you mean? It's all that anyone in the village can talk about. Just lucky the weather's like it is, or we'd be all over the news.
No doubt they'll be here soon enough. Have you heard from the Shannons?
No, not a whisper. Don't think we'll be seeing them this year. Staying put up on the cliff, so I heard. They've got the police and security up there. With one of their top guys gone missing this afternoon, as well as everything else, it's no wonder they're a bit jumpy.
Shame, though it would be nice to see as many souls as possible.
We'll miss the hefty donation, you mean?
No, I did not mean that,
she said, mocking hurt pride.
Though, you must admit, the money comes in handy when you're trying to keep this place going.
Yeah, but that's all you get from them, isn't it? Money. No bloody soul, that lot.
Why do you dislike them so much?
I don't dislike them, more what they stand for, the way they earn that wealth. You show me a global company, and I'll show you money made off the back of the poor and exploited. It's a fact, love.
She raised her eyebrows and carried on arranging the flowers in the large vase. She'd often noticed her husband's antipathy towards the Shannon family. He was a kind man who normally saw good in everyone, or at least tried to. His attitude towards the folk who did so much financially to keep the old church going seemed at odds with this. But, she pondered, who really knew anyone, even those closest to them? What fires in the heart were hidden beneath a smile, only hinted at by a chance remark or unguarded expression? She studied her husband again. Everyone had fires in their heart. Daly drove carefully along the road to Blan. He had asked the council to try and keep the route clear, and was pleased to see a large yellow gritting lorry out spreading salt on the highway, orange lights flashing. Large walls of white snow stood sentry on each side of the road, luminous in the moonlight. He and Dunn hadn't spoken much since leaving Kinloch. Just a few comments about the weather, and how, for the time being at least, the snow had abated. The clouds had indeed parted, allowing the moon to cast a blue light over the hills, trees, and fields of South Kintyre. Here and there, candles flickered in the windows of farmhouse cottages on the way to Blan. According to the electricity company, there was no chance that the supply would be restored until the next day, and only then if no more snow fell. The whole country had been affected, stretching the emergency services all over Scotland to the limit.
"It's really beautiful," said Mary, looking out on the moonlit scene.
"Yes, it is. Pity we're up to our ears in blood and gore, as usual."
"Please don't resign, Jim. Don't leave the job."
"Eh? Sorry? Wow, I don't know what to say."
"You don't need to say anything. I'm sure there's time for you to reconsider."
"Yes, there is, but what's the point?"
"The point is that you're a good detective and a good man. The police force needs more people like you, not fewer."
She looked at him and touched his arm.
"And I'll miss you."
Daly could feel tears welling up in his eyes, and he swallowed back the lump in his throat. He'd become used to wondering where his wife was or what she was doing over the years. In the last few months, however, and despite his best efforts, he had found it impossible to get the picture of Mary from his mind. He could feel her, touch her, even smell her, as he remembered their nights making love, the breeze moving the light curtains, wafting the scents of summer into the small bedroom of her cottage. Then, as had happened with his wife, darker visions plagued him. This girl, this beautiful woman, being wholly possessed, consumed, taken by another. Someone else's hands on her smooth flesh, another tasting the sweetness on her lips as her body arched with pleasure. Now, here they were, alone for the first time in months, and she was telling him that she would miss him. This joy, he felt, was unexpected and bittersweet. And what if I did stay? What then?
You'd be doing a job you're brilliant at, a job that needs to be done.
And stopping you from missing me?
Yes, that too.
Listen, Mary, I started thinking about leaving the police when Brian was lying in the hospital at death's door. What's happened since has done nothing to change my mind. I'm afraid that making sure that you won't miss me is not a good enough reason to carry on. I'm sorry.
Oh, she said, after a few moments. I'm sorry I said anything.
Don't be like this, snapped Daly in frustration. You must know how I feel about you. Surely you realise what it's like for me.
And what do you think it's like for me? I see you all the time. I know you've been with her. I can sometimes even smell her on you.
Oh, don't be ridiculous, he replied, realising, even as he spoke, that he experienced exactly the same feelings in reverse. You see, that's one of the reasons I need to go.
This is all totally fucked up. Do you really believe that I love Angus?
Well, I assumed.
To assume is to make an ass of you and me. That's what D.S. Scott says.
Oh, I know what D.S. Scott says.
Please, not here, not now, but soon. Can we talk properly, I mean?
What the fuck is that? Asked Daly, slowing up the car.
Up ahead, on top of a hill, red and yellow flames stood out in the pale landscape. Scott and a string of locals trooped through the snow to the old kirk. It stood at the edge of the village, silhouetted against the snow and moonlight, and surrounded by dark trees. Scott stared out across the bay. He could just make out the old promontory that thrust into the sea, where once a castle had stood. He had enjoyed talking to Jock about the history of the village. Many a battle and much blood had been spilt in and around the fortress. It was being spilt again, thought Scott. Despite his age and the conditions underfoot, Jock kept up a smart pace. He was tall, and his long legs ate away the yards, leaving Scott breathing heavily.
"You're fair pecking, Brian," said Jock with a chuckle. "I must admit to being a wee bit out of condition. I'm going to fix it, though. I walk 3 miles every morning and play a round of golf in the afternoon. I've been doing it for years. Nothing like it for a healthy constitution. Look at that lot," he said, jerking his thumb at the group of young men behind. "All got great guts and pudding faces. Half of them sit behind desks all week, while the other half lean against a wall watching cattle being milked by a machine. They all guzzle more beer than is good for them, and eat like plough horses." "Oh, aye," Scott replied. "Ever thought of the church as a second career? You've got the right voice for it. I can just see you haranguing the odd sinner from the pulpit." "Funny you should say that. My late father was a man of the cloth. Ugh, different days they were, altogether."
They walked along the road, a dark ribbon in the snow. All was quiet, save for the chatter behind them, and the crunch of their boots on the newly gritted roads.
"Bugger me, but it's cold," declared Scott. "Ugh, away with you. Bracing, that's what it is. A few hymns and a prayer or two will soon warm you up. It's a long time since I've been in a church. The Lord loves no one more than a sinner that repents."
Before long, they spotted candlelight flickering through the arched windows of the church, and made their way down the gravel drive and out of the snow. Daly had parked the car in a lay-by and was staring up the hill at the fire. He knew that people in this area celebrated the coming of the new year in many strange ways, many dating back hundreds of years. But there was something about the fire he didn't like, something that set his instincts on edge.
"How far away do you think that is?" he asked Dunn.
"I don't know. A couple of miles or so, maybe a bit more. You're surely not thinking of hiking up there to investigate?
No, I'm not that keen, he laughed. We'd get lost in the dark or end up stuck in a drift. I just think it's strange, that's all. When we get to Blan, I'll get hold of Willie Pollock, see if he can throw any light on it.
He turned to walk back to the car, but she stood still in front of him, staring up at his face.
Can you hold me? Just for a second.
For the briefest second, Daly hesitated, before reaching out to embrace her. He felt her shiver, and rubbed his hand up and down her back to warm her.
Please stay, sir.
The church was warmer than outside, but not much. The light from the many candles shimmered, casting shadows on the good folk of Kinloch, as they prepared to say goodbye to the old year and greet the next. Scott was surprised at the number of people who streamed in, from old, stooped men and women to young children. It was clear that the kirk was still popular in Blan.
A good turnout, said Jock, in what Scott assumed was intended as a whisper, but still resonated in the cold air.
That's the minister's bonny wife in the red dress.
All right, said Scott,
remembering that she and her husband had found the small skeleton on the rat stone the day before.
Aye, bonny and young, Jock, said an old man, turning to address them from the front pew. No wonder the minister has a smile on his face every time I see him.
The woman beside lifted a mitted hand and slapped him on the back of the head.
Peter, did I no tell you not to say a word about this before we left the house? You're obsessed with that poor lassie. What the minister does is his ain affair.
See, poor lassie, he replied, I don't hear you referring to Gertie or Peggy or there as lassies.
That's 'cause they're no. You're just jealous of the man. I can see it a mile off. If a younger woman would take you on, you'd be off like a shot. Is that no right, Jock?
All I'll say, Kathleen, is that the good Lord is first to take the righteous to his breast. So I think you'll be keeping a hold of Peter here for a good while yet.
Mair's the pity,
she said, as the pair settled back. Scott watched a line of men and one woman walk onto the dais below the pulpit.
What are they all about, Jock?
That's the kirk elders. We'll be in business shortly.
The music from the old organ swelled, and presently the Reverend Ignatius Moore appeared from the vestry door, dressed in dog collar and white surplice and clutching a large Bible. He climbed the short stairs to the pulpit, placed the Bible on the lectern in front of him, and looked out over his large congregation.
"Welcome, one and all, on this last night of the old year. It's my privilege to be before you tonight in this house, as always."
He smiled, then started to cough.
"Excuse me," he said, reaching under the lectern. "Bit of a frog in the old throat."
He put a mug of water to his lips, then started to splutter.
"Oh, shit!"
he shouted, his Australian accent suddenly pronounced, as he began to retch. The old man in front of Scott turned around in his pew.
"Can I say I've heard any minister say that before, eh, Jock? It's just an affront. Odds on the man's fair knackered keeping his wife at bay. Bound to tell on a man of his age. He's only a couple of years younger than me."
"If he's only a couple of years younger than you, you'd better get up there and have a drink of whatever he's having," said his wife.
Veronica rushed to her husband's side. His face was red, in stark contrast to his grey hair. Scott excused himself as he pushed his way along the pew.
"I'm a police officer," he said,
rushing up the aisle towards the pulpit, the eyes of the congregation upon him.
"There was something in my drink,"
spluttered Moore, regaining some of his composure.
"What, poison?"
asked Scott, looking for the receptacle.
"Oh, for all that's holy!"
Veronica fished an object out of the mug. She screamed and let it slip from her fingers, to bounce down the short row of pulpit steps and land at Scott's feet. He picked it up, then recoiled. It was now clear why the Reverend Moore had choked. Scott held a finger, pulped at the end where it had been severed from the rest of the hand, bearing a complex and distinctive gold ring.
"I don't suppose anyone's missing a finger," he said, holding up the item as a murmur of disgust spread around the old kirk at Blan.
Chapter 18.
"I see you've hurt your own hand," said Daly.
The church was empty now, save for himself, Scott, the Moors, D.C. Dunn, and Roy Simpson, an elderly farmer and church officer.
"Ah, this," said the Reverend Moore, holding up his bandaged hand. "The perils of DIY, Mr. Daly. I was trying to fix my bloody snow shovel, as it goes."
Mr. Simpson clucked at the oath.
"Sorry, Roy. Still a bit off my stride, mate. It's not every day you nearly swallow someone's finger."
Daly looked at the severed digit, now sealed up in a polythene evidence bag. The ring looked expensive, the design unusual.
"Take some pictures of this with your phone, please, D.C. Dunn." "Are you going to put it on your wall, Jimmy?" asked Scott.
"No, I'm going up to Kersevay House. When it comes to expensive designer jewellery, they're most likely to fit the bill, wouldn't you say?" He watched as Dunn took a couple of shots on her camera.
"Give it to the next cop going back to Kinloch and get it through the books and up to Glasgow at the first opportunity. I know that could be some time, given the weather conditions."
Veronica looked on quietly. The bandage on her husband's hand had been roughly applied, probably by himself. Why he hadn't asked for her help? She had wondered why he had been wearing gloves as they prepared for the service. Obviously it hadn't all been about the biting cold.
"Ach, it's a terrible thing. The last time anything like this afflicted the kirk would be way back at the time of the Covenanters," said Mr. Simpson, shaking his head. "Back then the minister had a rare taste for blood. He couldna see the MacDonalds spill enough of the stuff. It's terrible, just terrible. Old Mrs. Beaton fainted away when she seen that awful thing. You have my sympathies, Reverend Moore."
"What about the guy that's lost his finger?" asked Scott. "I dare say he's no feeling too chipper either."
"Who put the mug of water there?" asked Daly.
"That would be me, officer," replied Simpson. "It's my job to make sure that the minister is catered for, help him on with his vestments, make sure the church is in order, put out the hymn books, all that sort of thing."
"So when you filled the mug, there was definitely nothing in it?"
"Funny, I've been thinking about that. I just picked the mug off the shelf in the kitchen, filled it and took it through to the kirk. I cannae remember looking in it at all."
"Surely you would have noticed a finger floating about," said Scott.
"How would you? Do you stare into your mug of tea every time you pour it? I certainly don't.
Remind me never to come to your house for dinner."
"Okay," said Daly. "To your knowledge, who has had access to the church since you opened it this evening?"
"Ah, now, there's a thing, Mr. Daly," replied the Reverend Moore. "We don't open the church as such."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning it's a proper place, a place of worship, just like it should be. The door to the Lord's house is never closed to them that's looking for salvation," said Simpson. "I'm no even sure if the locks on the big doors turn. That's the way it is in Blan."
"There wouldn't be one nail left in the place if it was where I come fae," said Scott. "Never mind pews and the like. I think it's time you reviewed your security policy to fit in the realities of life in the 21st century."
"Oh, is that a fact? To be like the folks up in Glasgow, no doubt. Well, no thanks," said Simpson. "We've got half of the police force here, and there's folk getting butchered all over the village. My old feyther is likely turning in his grave."
"Around here I wouldn't be surprised if he was up dancing about," replied Scott.
He turned red when he realised that everybody was staring at him.
"Just an expression, if you know what I mean."
"I don't suppose you saw anything, Mrs. Moore?"
asked Daly, taking his eyes off his flustered DS. Veronica burst into tears.
"I'm sorry. It's all just too horrible," she sobbed,
lowering herself into a pew, her head in her hands. Moore sat down beside his wife and held her.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Daly. First that skeleton, then all the rest of the trouble that's happened in the last day or so. My wife is quite fragile, I'm afraid."
Daly looked on as Veronica shrugged out of her husband's embrace and ran out of the church.
"You'll excuse me," said Moore,
rushing after her.
"What's all that about?"
asked Scott, looking puzzled.
"Not to worry, Brian. She's probably off to have a word with some of these dancing corpses you were talking about. Aye, a slip of the tongue, Jimmy, sorry." "Ach, she's a delicate flower, right enough," said Simpson. "Had a hard time in the nunnery, by all accounts. The nuns fair bullied her, so I'm told."
"Aye, they nuns can be right bastards. We're never done lifting them for brawling in the street and harassing decent folk,"
said Scott, as Dunn stifled a laugh.
"You may jest, but I'll tell you something for nothing. That poor lassie had a terrible time with him. That's how she left."
"Lost the habit,"
said Scott, much to Daly's distaste.